So it's my pleasure to introduce Eric Barreto. Thank you for your message last night. We appreciated that. Eric is an associate professor of New Testament at Princeton Theological Seminary. First visit to Holden, and is here with his family, and we're so grateful you made the pilgrimage. And he is talking on believing and belonging in Luke Acts. Thank you, Eric.
Thank you.
Okay.
Good morning, friends.
Well, good to see you all this morning. Looking forward to spending some time hanging out in the Gospel of Luke and the Acts of the Apostles this week. Where I want to start is by noticing that we have a significant problem before us. And the problem is this, is that even as our communities are changing, even as our nation is changing, as our neighbors are changing, as their faces and their language and their countries of origin are changing, I find that in churches more and more, we have a hard time wrestling with the realities of different people in our communities, especially theologically. Sometimes we can say something political about the presence of newcomers in our midst. Sometimes we can say something socially about the presence of diversity in our communities. But when it comes to thinking theologically about our differences, I feel like we run into significant problems along the way, and that we haven't had tapped in fully into the resources of Scripture to think about how God nourishes our sense of imagination and our sense of hopefulness around our differences. I also worry that flawed and marred assumptions about what the Bible says about our differences have found their way not just into our churches, but into our wider culture. And when I look at the ways that some among us think about the arrival of immigrants, I think about the images that we've seen recently at our border. I wonder if we have a starved theological imagination, and that Scripture can actually help us have a much more robust and much more theologically informed imagination around our differences. I still remember right after Barack Obama's first election, there was a lot of people in the news saying that we've reached a post-racial moment in this country, that somehow we've set aside the sins of our past and we've gotten to a much better place. We've been paying attention. I think that's not exactly what's happened in our midst. I also think about, are there any fans of the NBA? Any NBA fans? Maybe? A few, okay. So I'll just talk to you all. Okay. A few years ago, the owner of the LA Clippers got in trouble for racist remarks he made on tape that were released. It was during the playoffs. Mm-hmm. It was just this big scandal in the basketball world. And the next time the Clippers had a playoff game, it was at their home court. And the announcers threw it to David Aldridge, who's a sideline reporter for TNT, and David Aldridge is an African-American. And he said, they passed it to him, and he announced that he has 10-year-old son, who is also African-American, of course, had asked his dad, "Daddy, are they going to let you in the arena tonight?" Whoa. And David Aldridge, on the air, says, "I'm here, son, let's play ball." And the announcers got really quiet for like another minute, which, you know, if you watch basketball, you know that's impossible for them. These are incredibly hard conversations for us to have. We're going to make mistakes along the way. We're going to hurt one another. And we're going to constantly have to be seeking forgiveness from one another when we hurt one another and repair for the relationships that we've torn asunder. But I want to suggest to you this week that we can't help but have these conversations. And that when we have these conversations and we gather around Scripture, my conviction is that the Holy Spirit shows up and enlightens for us all the possibilities before us. So I want to start with a little bit of storytelling. So what I'd like to invite you to do is to turn to one another and to one person near you, preferably somebody that you don't know already, but if that doesn't work out, that's fine too. But find somebody that maybe you don't live in the same household with. And I want you to share a story with that person. I want you to share a story about the first time you realized what your race was, or the first time you realized that there were people of other races in the world. So a story about the first time you realized what your race was, or the first time you remember realizing that there were people of other races in the world. Does that make more or less sense? Any questions? All right, let me give you a few minutes to do that. So turn to one another and speak to one another. Tell some stories.
I'm John.
What is our basketball?
I hate to stop good conversations. Hopefully you continue having these conversations over meals. I'm wondering if some of you might be willing to share some of your stories. Maybe your partner shared a really moving story and you want to elbow them down the ribs and tell them to share the stories with everyone. But I've got a microphone here. I'd love to hear a few of the stories in the room.
Oh, and I was, I grew up in a small little Norwegian white town. There were absolutely, for miles and miles, there were no people of color, except for Mexicans who worked in the field. And so when I went to college, I actually asked, I was curious about, you know, what African-American culture was like, and I asked for a black roommate. And they gave me, his name was Doug Hatcher, he was a nephew of the famous black politician at the time named Hatcher. I can't remember his first name. Anyway, I worked nights, and so I would sleep in the afternoon, and he would often come in about the time I was waking up. He'd be done with his classes, and he'd turn his music on and dance, and I thought that was delightful, you know. And one day we were talking about how he felt like there were people who were kind of out to get him because of his race. And I was waking up and leaned over. I was in the top bunk, and I leaned over and I said, well, I thought I could joke with him, you know. And I said, well, how do you know it's not your roommate? And he freaked out. He completely freaked out and went immediately to the administration and got asked for another roommate. And I realized at the time that my little joke was to him a deep fear. Mm-hmm. And so after that, I had many African American friends and dated an African American woman for a while. But that has always stuck with me, is how they live with that fear that I don't have. Right. Nobody's out to get Norwegians.
Yeah. Just the Swedes, right? No, thank you for sharing that story. That was really, really powerful. Thank you. Another let's share, please. We get my steps today.
The first part is very much like his. I grew up in the Red River Valley north of Fargo, Moorhead, really white Norwegian, and we also had Mexican people that came up to do the beet fields. And so in Sunday school, of course, we'd hear about missionaries in other lands, and those people had dark skin. So as an 8-year-old, I went to my first Minnesota Twins game. Big deal to go to Minneapolis for that. And so it happened to be picture-taking day. You could go on the field before the game, take pictures with the players. I got pictures of the players. And Lenny Green was sitting in the dugout. He was a Twins center fielder, African-American. And I got a chance to sit in the dugout next to Lenny Green. But I didn't say anything to him because he had dark skin and I didn't think he spoke English. That's an 8-year-old's view of it.
Yeah. Thank you for that. Yeah, the ways that... what we're taught in church just filters through our everyday encounters. Lovely. Two great stories. Two for two. Let's make it three for three.
This may not be three for three, but...
That's right.
Kind of a reverse. I also grew up in a Norwegian, southeastern Minnesota white community. Very Lutheran, but my Sunday school had to go to Northfield, Minnesota just to visit Catholics, which was a great trip. But when I was older in college, I ran out of gas on a freeway, and I was desperately trying to get my car off the freeway before the highway patrol came by and gave me a ticket for running out of gas on a freeway, which I thought that might happen. But as I was pushing my car, a bunch of people surrounded me and said, and one guy said, get in, we'll push. So they pushed me over a hill down the exit ramp and got out, and there were these, what I would perceive as inner city black men, my age, but that was my first real encounter as being a minority. But the interesting thing was they helped me so much that there was no race involved that I could tell. I mean, I was just a guy who needed help. And they had a gas can in their trunk. I got in the back seat of a 2-door car, and then when I got in and shut the door with all this rap banging in my in speakers, I thought, okay, I'm out of my element here. What am I doing? But they brought me to a gas station. They left on an errand. The gas station closed. I'm sitting on a curb with the guy's gas can, thinking, what's going to happen now? Well, they came back, put the gas in my car, made sure the car started and I was on my way. Well, we had this conversation. You know, they grew up in Minneapolis. I grew up in southern Minnesota. I was guiding winter camping trips for a Lutheran camp in northern Minnesota. And they thought I was just nuts. You go camping in the winter? But yeah,
I don't understand that.
Want to come with me? Looking back, it was a experience that I had as a minority in that situation with no race. I mean, they were just helping this guy, and as far as I could tell, we were just people helping each other, which, if we did that now, would be a better place in the world. But
thank you for sharing that. Yeah, these chance encounters that sometimes don't feel so chance, sorry about that, but because they feel so meaningful, are often the ways that our imaginations are shaped and reshaped. Lovely. Anybody else? We've all heard of it. Just three dudes, so we do need it. Okay, thank you.
I speak for all women.
Or at least one.
Right. I moved from rural Iowa to Atlanta when I was 10 years old, and in rural Iowa, my third grade class makeup was, there was one interracial person who was half black, and then when I moved to my elementary school in Atlanta, I was one of six white kids in my grade. And I was saying to my people around me, I think I realized there were different races with my third grade classmate, but I didn't realize I was white until I was in the minority.
Powerful. Anybody else? Don't want to close off the possibilities, please.
Well, I grew up in a small community as well, but then when I was a freshman, we moved. This wasn't the first time I realized different races, but we moved from this small town to St. Paul. And I went to St. Paul Central, which was in the inner city, and very mixed relations, or mixed races. And I have distinct memories of the groups of blacks, and it was during 1968, when you had the racial tensions. There were times when they closed off parts of the school because of racial tension. But I learned to appreciate that culture through that experience. And it's just that it was an awareness, you know.
Mm-hmm. Great, thank you. I think this is an important place to start, because so often how we think about our differences are narrated. They're these stories that we carry within ourselves, often stories that we haven't really told to one another, or stories that feel so natural that we don't stop to think about how narrated, how storied they are. When I ask this question in rooms when there are more minoritized people, more people of color, inevitably somebody responds, I don't remember the first time I realized that I was a particular race, because it was something I always knew. I think often folks, and I think we heard a story like this, in majority culture, a culture that supports our sense of identity, we don't have to stop and think about our identity. It's kind of adhered to us. We kind of adopt it. For those of us in communities of color, often it's an identity that's always before us. We never forget that we're Latinx, or for some people, African American or Asian American. It's always something that we're always sensing at our fingertips. So I think that's one reality. The other reason I think it's important to share these stories is for us to hear the emotions that are coming through in so many of these stories. In these stories, we hear emotions about joy and discovery, especially in childhood stories. I hear a lot of stories about people, the simple joys of children finding one another as friends, and then encountering some sense of difference. I've heard a lot of stories where, you know, a white young person is friends with an African-American young child, and then when the white person's parents figure out that they're friends with this person, they ask them not to be friends. So it's that sense of joy, but then that sense of disappointment, of loss. If we keep sharing stories, we might hear emotions of fear, of concern, of hurting one another, of having to seek repair. So that when we think about race and ethnicity, even when we're thinking about it theologically, we're not just thinking about ideas, we're thinking about how we feel. and how we move through the world. I did ask you to share your story, so let me just share a couple of mine. I was born in outside of San Juan, Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico, as you know, is the most beautiful island in the world. Everybody agrees with this. I'm always a beach person, but when I come to places like this, I'm like, oh, I can be a mountain person too, right? These places work. So when I was 5 years old, I went to school inside an American military base. I'd grown up speaking Spanish, so I went to school when I was 5 years old, and I knew yes, no, and where's the bathroom. I had to learn the rest of my English along the way. We moved from Puerto Rico to Slidell, Louisiana when I was 9 years old. Anybody know where Slidell, Louisiana is? Right? It's just like Puerto Rico, right? It's not any culturally different. No, it's very different. It was quite a cultural shock for us. One of the things I remember is when I showed up, the style in Puerto Rico was to wear tube socks up to your knees, but that was not the style at the time in Slidell, Louisiana, so my new friends would tell me right away I was wearing my socks all wrong. When you're a teenager, all you want to do, of course, is to fit in, and I got really good at that. I remember, in early middle school, there was this one young man, a friend of mine, who got way more attention from girls than I did. So I sat there and I was like, just racking my brain, trying to figure out what he has that I don't. And I was like, I finally figured it out. This friend of mine had thin lips, so I would go home and practice. It didn't work. But like I said, when you're a teenager, you just get really good at fitting in. And I got really, really good at it. And my friends would come up to me and they'd throw their arm around my shoulder and say, you know, Eric, we don't even see you as Puerto Rican, you're one of us. And my teenage heart was just so happy because all I wanted was to be accepted, to be embraced. But now I look back on that and I think rather differently about those encounters. My friends were trying to be loving. They were trying to be inclusive. They were trying to help me find a place. But in doing so, they were denying a critical part of who God made me to be, of the land that formed me, of the food that nourished me, of the language we spoke at home. They were trying to include me, but include me on their terms, not on the terms of the place and the people and the language and the food and the culture that God gave me as a gift to figure out who I was in the world. Second story, I was interviewing for a job, I will not say where, but it was that part of the interview, it was on the phone too, that's another important part of this, but it was that part of the interview where they ask you if you have any questions, so you relax a little bit, and you start peppering them with questions because they've been mean to you for an hour. And in the middle of somebody answering one of the questions I posed, somebody stepped in and said, well, hold on a second. All the people sitting around this table are white. Reading your resume, I would just assume you're white too. I don't know what that means, but right? He would say, how are you going to attract Hispanic people to our institution? And later on, of course, you think of the things you wanted to say. I should have said, would it help if I had an accent? Would it help if I were mowing your lawn? I don't know, right? You think about these things. So we have these moments. We have these stories that we're carrying within us. And
you
these stories.
Speak Spanish to them?
I could have spoken Spanish to them. That would have solved it right away, right? So we're carrying around these stories within us. Stories of hope, stories of loss, stories of great moments of encounter, stories of scary moments of encounter. And all these stories we carry with us, we need to speak them out loud, because if we don't, they're going to keep forming us without us knowing that they're forming us. And what I want to do this week is bring our stories to the forefront, but also bring the stories of the Gospel of Luke and the Acts of the Apostles alongside too, how those stories and our stories are places where God shows up and where God teaches us something new about what God is up to in the world. As I said earlier, these are really complicated questions. And one way we get to this is, I wanted to show you a commercial that came on during the Super Bowl a few years ago. I don't remember which one exactly. But this commercial came on, and then Twitter went a little bit nutty. You'll see why right away.
So we bow down among a brood of
So my favorite comment was, how dare they ruin the national anthem? Think about it. Yeah. All right. As you can imagine, there are two sides on Twitter. Some people love this commercial. It represented who they were, who their communities were, and they were glad to see that reflected in this kind of national stage. There are people who are part of the majority culture who saw themselves as wanting to be a part of this diverse community of different languages. So even though they didn't see themselves exactly in this commercial, this is the kind of place they wanted to be a part of. And of course, some people were really afraid of this and were really disappointed by it. That it represented not this growing into a diverse set of communities, but a loss of something important. A loss of the national anthem, a loss of a sense of identity. So both of those were represented out there. But of course, why did Coca-Cola make that commercial?
Money.
To sell high fructose corn syrup in a bottle, right? They see where the market is going, they see where the money is going, and they see an ever more diverse country, and they know where the money's going to be, so they keep directing towards that. And even if they bother some people, you know, all publicity is good publicity, of course, right? They're doing this to make money. They're doing this because they're reading the market. And notice how motivated by profit, they tell a really compelling, beautiful, and simple story. For some reason in the church, we've not been able to tell an equally compelling, simple, beautiful story about our differences. Even though those beautiful, simple, compelling stories are already our texts. They're already here. I don't know about you, but I grew up in a church where our differences were a problem that we needed to solve. We would read Galatians chapter 3, where Paul says that in Christ there is no Jew or Greek, no slave or free, no male and female. And what that meant in my church was that if there are problems around gender or around race, around social standing, then that's stuff you're bringing into the church. Because once you become a follower of Jesus, you become just like everyone else. There are now no differences among us because we're all now just followers of Jesus. I want to suggest this week that that's a truncated story about who God is and how God has created us. That God does not see our differences as a problem to solve, as an obstacle on the way to becoming the church God wants us to be, but the very place where today God is most living and active, where God is most shaping our communities, and where God might show us best what our future will look like. So, we're going to spend some time reading the Gospel of Luke and the Acts of the Apostles this week. I don't know if many of you hear readings from the Acts of the Apostles growing up, sermons about it. In my church, we often, I grew up in Southern Baptist churches, we would often turn to the Acts of the Apostles as a blueprint for putting together the perfect church. Maybe you heard this growing up in church. If we were just doing the church like they did in the Acts of the Apostles, we'd be a much better church, right? And of course, this makes sense in Acts chapter 4. The disciples and the followers of Jesus sell their possessions, they bring them into the feet of the disciples, and it says in Acts that there was not a needy person among them. And I think that's exactly the kind of community I want to be a part of. That sounds beautiful, that sounds lovely. So that happens at the end of chapter 4, but at the beginning of chapter 5, again, remember that chapters and verses were added later and sometimes in all the wrong places, because what happens at the beginning of chapter 5 is the first word in chapter 5 is the word, but. But Ananias and Sapphira, they lie to the Spirit, they lie to the church, people fall dead all of a sudden, and I read that story of Ananias and Sapphira, and I think, I want no part of that church. I want no part of a church where people are falling dead in the middle of it. The church in the Acts of the Apostles is as beautiful a church as I've ever seen, but as broken as a church as I've ever seen. The best way to read Acts is not to read it like a blueprint for putting together the perfect church, because you're not going to find a perfect church in the Acts of the Apostles. It's not a Lego manual for putting together a church. It's not even an IKEA instruction manual with all the pictures, right? It's a narrative. It's a story. And what is that narrative trying to do to us? How is it inspiring us? So let's think of one story in particular. So turn with me to Acts chapter 20. And then look at verse 7. Acts chapter 20, verse 7. This is the story of Eutychus. Anybody remember the name Eutychus? This is going deep into Bible trivia. Story of Eutychus. Okay. So in brief, we're going to read it here in a second, but in brief, right, Paul's preaching late into the night. He's a very boring preacher, apparently. Acts chapter 20, starting in verse 7. He's a very boring preacher, so there's poor Eutychus, and he falls out the window and he dies, and we're all supposed to laugh, but we'll see if this happens here. So, chapter 20, verse 7. On the first day of the week, when we met to break bread, Paul was holding a discussion with them. Since he intended to leave the next day, he continued speaking until midnight. There were many lamps in the room upstairs where we were meeting. A young man named Eutychus, who was sitting in the window, began to sink off into a deep sleep while Paul talked still longer. Overcome by sleep, Eutychus fell to the ground three floors below and was picked up dead. But Paul went down and, bending over him, took him in his arms and said, "Do not be alarmed, for his life is in him." You can just imagine how Eutychus must have looked after a three-story fall. Notice what happens here. Then Paul went upstairs, and after he had broken bread and eaten, he continued to converse with them until dawn. He's unfazed by this whole event. He just keeps talking. Then he left. Notice we still don't know what happened to poor Eutychus. Verse 12, "Meanwhile, they had taken the boy away alive and were not a little comforted." If I were to have read the story last night and I said at the end the word of the Lord, everybody would say, "Thanks be to God." Nobody would crack a smile. Nobody would laugh. This is a really funny story, right? Paul is such a boring preacher that somebody fell asleep and didn't just fall asleep, but they fell out of the window and he died. And then Paul said, no, he's fine. He's just asleep. He's okay. It's a really funny story. So if we look at this story, what do we do with it? There's a website called the Brick Testament. Anybody heard of the Brick Testament? It's this guy who takes Bible stories and uses Legos to tell those stories. But he picks only the bad stories, right? So all the most alarming stories in the Bible, especially in the Hebrew Scriptures. Apparently, he created a book, and they were selling the book at Sam's Club, and grandparents kept buying it for their grandkids without looking at it, and their grandkids were discovering all the nasty stories in the Bible. But anyway, this is the story with Timothy. It's less, less alarming. So you have Paul off preaching, "What a wretched man I am," and poor Eutychus falling out the window. And then in the next frame, Paul saying, "Do not be alarmed, there is life in him." But Eutychus doesn't look so great. If you look at his neck, and I don't know, he just doesn't look right. This is a story meant to delight us, to entertain us, to make us smile a little bit, to laugh at the things that happen in our churches. Do you know what the word Eutychus means in English? And in Greek, right, so it's a Greek term, it's a Greek name. His name means lucky. Another good layer to this story. I don't know how many sermons you've heard about Eutychus. Probably not that many. But if we treat the book of Acts like an instruction manual for putting together the perfect church, what does this story teach us? Right, keep the windows closed. Maybe put bars on them. Maybe don't preach boring sermons, which is a really good thing to learn, but probably not the point of this story.
Especially till midnight.
Especially till midnight, right? Yeah. So what if it's not those things? What else might it be doing? What if that story is meant to provoke our imagination? Make us wonder about what God is doing in our midst. And what if that story provokes us to imagine who are those young people at the corners of our communities, at the edges of our communities? And what we're doing at the center of our community is boring them to death. And those young people are at this precipice of death. And they have no idea how close they are to death. And we're boring them to death in the middle. So what might it look like for us to bring Eutychus away from that window, put him at the center of our worship, and say, "What is God showing you, Eutychus? What is God showing you, young person? Get away from death. We'll bring you right here to the very center of life and wonder how God is moving in your life." And that's how we're going to know what God is up to in the world. I'm convinced that the stories of Luke and the stories of Acts are meant much more to provoke our imaginations than provide a list of rules for us. They're meant to evoke our imaginations more than they tell us exactly what to do and how to do it and how to put together the perfect church, because there is no such thing. Luke, when I think about the Gospels, Luke could have chosen to just write a really extended Sermon on the Mountain, right? A list of all of Jesus' greatest teachings, a list of rules about how to put together the perfect church. But Luke doesn't do that. Instead, Luke tells all these fabulous, incredible stories, some of which we will read together this week. Why? Because the way we tell stories shapes us and forms us. It forms community, it forms us as individuals. These stories matter for how we imagine ourselves as children of God. So let's look at how Luke starts his story. So turn with me to Luke chapter 1, and we're going to read just the first couple of verses of the Gospel of Luke. When I teach Luke in the seminary, we spend like a whole couple of hours on just these first four verses. We won't be doing that this morning, so we'll just hang out a little bit in these together. But what Luke does in these first four verses is to pull back the curtain, to tell us why he thinks he's writing and what he hopes to accomplish. And I'm wondering if we might let Luke help shape our expectations and help shape our reading this week. So, Luke chapter 1, starting in verse 1. And as I'm reading this, I want you to think about what do you learn about what Luke thinks he's doing as we're reading these first four verses? What is Luke trying to do? What do we learn about Luke and his process as we read these? So, okay, Luke chapter 1, verse 1. Since many have undertaken to set down an orderly account of the events that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed on to us by those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and servants of the word, I too decided, after investigating everything carefully from the very first, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the truth concerning the things about which you have been instructed. That is one long Greek sentence. It's great in Greek, not so great in English, but we'll deal with that right now, right? So, those first four verses, what do you hear? What do you learn from Luke in these first four verses? Please.
The other accounts weren't necessarily very faithful.
Yeah, so tell me where you see that. I think there's something there, right?
Since many have undertaken to set down an account, right. I am now going to give you the correct
version. Right. So other people have done this before, right? And we know that Luke has at least Mark in front of him. So scholars mostly agree that Mark was probably the earliest. Both Matthew and Luke are using Mark independently of each other. But there's also material that's found in both Matthew and Luke, not just the same stories, but the very same words. So it seems there's this other set of documents that they both have access to. So he knows other people have tried to tell these stories, and he thinks they're insufficient in some way because he's not just saying, here's Mark, read this, here's Q, read this. But instead, he's writing his own story. The question is why? I think he thinks they're insufficient. But they're not so insufficient that he's not going to use a whole lot of them along the way. There's still something good there, but there's something missing. So let's see if we can figure out what might be missing. What else do you learn in these first four verses?
He talks about the truth.
The truth, yeah. So that's in verse 4. And what do you think he might mean by that?
I don't know. Maybe suggesting maybe that the others are not accurate or untrue in some way.
Yeah, so I think there's something missing in those other texts that he wants to fill in. What I think is important about truth here is what comes right after it. The truth concerning the things about which you have been instructed. So what do we notice here is that Luke is not for first-time hearers of the gospel. Luke here is thinking about people who already know the gospel, who are already followers of Jesus, but maybe they're starting to wonder about certain things. Maybe they've forgotten some of those truths that were shared with them. Maybe they've lost their way and they need to be brought back. There's a sense in which Luke here is correcting a community, trying to bring them back to something that they've already known.
Well, in this translation it says, I decided to write an orderly account to you. To me, if I were to take that, that would be a sequential.
Right.
An orderly or something a little more understandable.
Uh-huh.
Either sequential or understandable based on a timeline.
So verse 1 is super important. An orderly account. And the question is, what does Luke mean by an orderly account? So we might think it's chronological, right? So that he's trying to tell the story in the right order, chronologically. Where I hesitate to think that that's what Luke means is that in Luke 9:57, I think, Luke's Jesus sets his face toward Jerusalem.
Right, so it's part of this long travel narrative. Luke sets, Jesus sets his face toward Jerusalem. He doesn't get there until chapter 19. And if you plot the points on a map, it's like the divine GPS is broken. Like, he seems to be going everywhere. So I'm not sure that Luke is thinking here about chronology. I wonder if he means a different kind of order. And the order I think he's thinking of is literary and theological. So if these people are already Christians, then I wonder if a lot of the stories Luke tells are stories they already know. Right? They already know the story of the Good Samaritan, maybe, or the story of the prodigal son. But what they haven't heard is these stories told next to one another. So we'll end of the week, we'll look at Luke 15 on Friday. But think about Luke 15, the lost coin, the lost sheep, the prodigal son. What if those three stories, they all know those three stories, but they've not heard them together? So I wonder if it's a literary and a theological arrangement of these stories. If that's what Luke is after. That's what he means by orderly, not so much chronology or history, but theology and the way that he tells those stories. Okay. What else do you learn? Anything else in these first four verses?
Please. Well, he's claiming that the stories that he's working with were the authentic stories that came from people who saw them.
Yes. Look at verse 2. Number one, we learn that Luke wasn't there. He has to rely on the words of others to get to the truth of these stories. So verse 2, those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. How do you know you can trust these stories? Because I went back and talked to the people who were there. They were there, they saw it, they were eyewitnesses. I'm not an eyewitness, but they were. And therefore, you can trust what's happening in this text.
Good. Please.
And he also makes a point of saying that he's followed all things closely.
Yeah, that he's done the work.
Credentials.
Yes. Yeah, I think verse 2 and verse 3 are a bunch of credential display. I talked to the right people. I've studied it very carefully. It's a way of showing you can trust what's in this text. Who's it written to?
The Theophilus.
So for a long time, people thought that Luke Acts was an apology to the Roman Empire. That is, that this text was a way to say to the Roman Empire, we are not a threat to you, and that Theophilus was a Roman official who's received this long story to say, we're not a threat to you, we followers of Jesus can be left alone. Of course, this is a really long text for any Roman official to read, plus, if they don't know the Septuagint, if they don't know the stories of Israel, none of this is going to make any sense. What if Theophilus is someone else? So, look at Theophilus. Those of you who are Greek scholars, or even if you're not, you can probably figure this out. What does Theo mean?
God.
And Phyllis?
Brother.
Yeah, a lover. So a lover of God. What if this text is written to someone who loves God? To the community who loved God that Luke knew well, and now to us as well. When I think about Luke, I don't think about a historian or a scholar sitting in a room full of books. I think about a pastor, someone who loves their community deeply, who knows their deepest anxieties, who knows their biggest questions. And he's writing this story not because he wants to write some objective story. He's writing this story with their names and their faces in his mind. He knows their stories, he knows their questions, and he's writing directly to them and not to anybody else. Anything else? Any questions or thoughts about those first four verses? Please, yeah.
What do you make of the words most excellent?
So it's this kind of honorific, right? So, and I think in that way, it may be that Luke is lifting us up as readers as well, to say that we're our beloved children of God, lifting us up to say, this is a text for you and for all people. Now, lots of people disagree with me on this in the scholarship. People still think Theophilus is some individual, some official, but I like to imagine that Theophilus is you and me and everyone else who's picked up the gospel. Any other thoughts or questions about those first four verses? Marvelous. Okay, so we read Luke Acts by reading with imagination and hope, reading these stories as stories and not a list of instructions. And we primarily read this by letting these texts engage our imaginations. So this is the argument I'm going to make all week, not whether we thought about how we're going to read Luke Acts. I'm going to argue that Luke Acts sees our differences as a gift, not a problem to be solved. There's three parts to that.
One is I'm going to suggest this week that our differences and our diversities are unavoidable. They're unavoidable. They're always before us. A couple of you told stories about living in communities where you didn't encounter much difference. And that's becoming less and less common. It's amazing to me how many stories I've heard of people going to college or serving in the military, and that's when they encounter difference. I think that happened often for a lot of folks, for a lot of generations. When I think about my children, they're encountering difference in a way that I had never encountered. That the communities, whether urban or rural, are far more diverse than they ever have been. And school classrooms are far more diverse than they've ever been. So our children are encountering difference. We're encountering difference in our communities, in our neighborhoods, in the grocery store. But not only that, but we've got, I usually carry my phone, but not here, right? We've got these devices in our pockets that are connecting us to a bigger world all the time. Our differences and our diversities are simply unavoidable. If we could have one day lived in cocoons of similarity and pretended that the rest of the world didn't exist, that reality is slowly going away. Number two, though, more importantly, is that our differences and our diversities are indispensable, that we need them. Here I want to use an example from the great church historian Justo Gonzalez. So Justo Gonzalez is an Augustine in the early church and writes everything on the church, but he also wrote a little book called Santa Biblia, which is just Spanish for Holy Bible. And there he talks about how different Latinx communities read the scriptures. And he points to one story in particular. Do you remember the story of the laborers in the Gospel of Matthew, right? So there's the landowner, and he goes to the market, and he hires people early in the morning, and a couple hours later, and he just keeps hiring people all throughout the day. You get to the end of the day, and what happens? He starts by paying the people who've only been working for like an hour. They've barely broken a sweat, no calluses on their hands, no blisters on their feet. And what do they get? They get a day's wage. So the people who started working at 9 o'clock, who are calloused and blisters and sweaty, they think we've hit the lottery. Because if those lazy bums got a full day's wage, just imagine what's coming to us. But what does the landowner do is he goes through and gives everyone the same wage. In the church where I grew up, and perhaps in the church where you grew up too, the way we read that story is that what that means is that our sense of fairness is here, and God's sense of justice is up here somewhere. It's strange. It's something that we can't really understand. And what the landowner does is fundamentally unfair, because people who worked harder and longer should not be paid the same as people who only worked for an hour. But because this is how God's justice is aligned, we think about fairness like this, but God's justice is up here and unknowable, then you just got to deal with it because God said so, right? Because that's just the way it is. Gonzalez observes that that's how the stories were read in a lot of middle-class, majority-culture congregations. But he says if you go to an immigrant community, people read that story very differently. In those communities, people have sat in marketplaces looking for work, waiting for work. They know what it's like for the day to be getting along, and knowing they needed to get a job to feed their families that day. They know that experience of hoping against hope all day. What they see in their community is not that God's sense of justice is up here and our sense of fairness is here, but that God's justice and our deepest needs meet. That it wasn't the fault of the people who got hired at the end of the day that they didn't get a job earlier in the day. They were at the marketplace, they were ready to work, they were willing to work, they needed to work. What the landowner does is provide everyone exactly what they need. So as I told you, I grew up in Puerto Rico, which meant I was born with U.S. citizenship. So when we moved from Puerto Rico to Louisiana, that was culturally complicated, but not legally complicated. We just got on a plane and went. It was no big deal in that sense. So there's a whole community of people whose experiences of migration and immigration I just didn't understand. And when we lived in Atlanta, we owned a little house. And when it was time for me to do a home project, I'd go to the local Home Depot. And of course, in the parking lot, there would be a group of men looking for work. So I'd go early in the morning, I'd get the stuff I needed, I'd go work on my project. Because I'm really bad at this stuff, I'd break something or mess something up, and I'd go back to Home Depot to get more stuff.
which I think is their marketing approach, because you never go to Home Depot once, right? You always go a million times. So I'd go back, and there'd be a group of people still waiting for work. Fewer of them, but still waiting for work. And I'd keep coming back, and those men would still be there. I needed the help of my neighbors to help me see the depths of that story. On my own, I'd still be thinking about fairness and justice like this. But with the help of my neighbors and their stories, I could read the Bible in all its possibilities. This is what I tell my students, is that there's certain things in the Bible I can see really clearly. My vision straight ahead is really, really clear. And my experience as a man, as a Latinx person, as a Puerto Rican, I can see certain things really clearly that other people can't. And that the things that I see, I need to share with others. Otherwise, they won't be able to read that on their own. But the reality is also that my peripheral vision is really, really fuzzy. And because I'm not a woman, because I'm a straight person, because I'm not an African-American, there are certain parts, certain experiences of my neighbors that allows them to see something in the Bible that I cannot see. And I need their help to see the Bible in all their fullness. None of us ever reads the Bible by ourselves. We need the help of others to see all the things that God might be teaching us in these texts. And therefore, our differences and our diversities are indispensable. Without different neighbors, we can't be the people that God has called us to be. We need each other's help to learn the shape of faith, but also to learn the shape of the scriptures. And last, number three, is that our differences and diversities are a gift from God. They're a gift from God. And my worry is that I've been to too many churches where difference is assumed to be a problem, a puzzle. How many churches have I been to where people say, there are all these new people in our community, how can we get them to come to our church? How many churches have I been to where the sign in the front says, everyone is welcome? But there should be a little asterisk on that sign, because what we really mean is everyone is welcome as long as you become like us. Everyone is welcome as long as you worship like us. Everyone is welcome as long as you don't try to change us at all. Everyone is welcome on our terms. We tend to see our differences as a problem we need to solve, as an obstacle on the way to becoming the church God wants us to be. I want us to imagine our differences as a gift that God has given us, not a curse, not an affliction, not a problem, but pure gift. A pure way that we can see what God is up to in the world. So to get us started, I want us to look at a few stories of healing in the Gospel of Luke. So there are some folks with dish duties, so they're heading their way. Oh, no worries, no worries. No worries. If they don't go, we don't have clean dishes, so you know. Everybody wants to eat lunch, right? So I want to look a little bit at the healing stories in the Gospel of Luke. Just really briefly, we're going to do this. Too often, I think, we think about the healing stories as preludes to the Gospel, as appetizers, and that the Gospel is the main meal. That the healings are ways that Jesus draws a crowd so that then he can tell them the Gospel. And the reason I think this is because of my experiences in the church growing up when we went on mission trips. When we went on mission trips, we would, you know, build a house or dig a well or do VBS or something, like do something good for people so that they would then come to our worship service at night and then we could tell them the good news about Jesus. Forgetting that digging that well is the good news. Building that house is the good news itself. So a couple of examples of this. So look, let's turn to first Luke chapter 4. We'll come back to Luke chapter 4 tomorrow, but we're going to look at the end of that chapter. So look at chapter 4 starting in verse 31. So Jesus went down to Capernaum. So Luke chapter 4 starting in verse 31. Jesus went down to Capernaum, a city in Galilee, and was teaching them on the Sabbath. They were astounded at his teaching because he spoke with authority. And here I think what's important is that when Luke says Jesus spoke with authority,
It doesn't mean he's got like an awesome James Earl Jones voice, like that really gravelly, this is CNN, right? It means something else. So the story's going to teach us what it means when Jesus speaks with authority. In the synagogue, there was a man who had the spirit of an unclean demon, which always cracks me up because are there clean demons around, right? Like it seems kind of, I think it's just Luke emphasizing how bad a demon this is, right? So it's an unclean demon. And he cried out with a loud voice, "Let us alone. What have you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God." But Jesus rebuked him, saying, "Be silent and come out of him." When the demon had thrown him down before them, he came out of him without having done him any harm. They were all amazed and kept saying to one another, "What kind of utterance is this? For with authority and power he commands the unclean spirits, and out they come." And a report about him began to reach every place and region. I worry that too much of our imaginations have been shaped by movies like The Exorcist, so demon possessions seem like these strange things for movie theaters and not for everyday life. If you've spent time with Christians in other parts of the world, we know that the experience of demon possession is still real for a lot of communities. But so often for us in the West, we try to figure out, okay, well, this person had a mental illness or some sort of disease or something that Jesus is healing. We kind of want to domesticate this story because we don't want to deal with the fact that people might be invaded by a demon and that Jesus might need to rebuke that demon. What I've been starting to wonder is if we might think about demons in a different way, not like The Exorcist. But what is this demon here? This demon is a force that comes from the outside of someone. We don't know where that force comes from. We can't explain its origins. But wherever that force goes, it just brings death and destruction in its wake. It tears apart people. It tears apart communities. It brings death where there should be life. And nobody can do anything about this demon. Nobody can send it away. Nobody can fix it. And are there any parts of our world that are forces that seem to come from outside of us that no one knows where they come from exactly and that no one seems able to control? Can we think of some examples like that in our world? They may not look like the demons in The Exorcist, but we know what it looks like when it looks like racism, when it looks like gun violence, when it looks like domestic violence. These forces that seem to come from nowhere and that no one seems to be able to control. So notice what Jesus does is that he's able just with his words to send away this demon. And notice that people are amazed by the authority and the power that his voice has, not because his voice is deep and gravelly, not because his words are beautiful, but because his words are effective. When he speaks, the world changes. That's what healing looks like in this exorcism. Not just the miraculous fireworks of sending away a demon and somebody's head spinning around, but the transformative work of sending this force away. And notice, it's not just this demoniac who's made well. It's the whole community as well. Because as long as that person is invaded by this unclean demon, that's not the only person that's harmed. It's everybody else around him as well. And then notice what Luke does right after us in verse 38. This is very Lucan. He'll tell a story about a man, and then he'll tell a story about a woman. So after leaving the synagogue, he entered Simon's house. Now Simon's mother-in-law was suffering from a high fever, and they asked him about her. Then he stood over her and rebuked the fever, and it left her. Immediately she got up and began to serve them. So notice that word in verse 39, rebuke. Where else have you heard that word before? Look at verse 35, but Jesus rebuked him. The same word that is used to send away the demon is used to send away this fever. Right, so notice the similarity between these two. These are both forces of death. There isn't aspirin and Tylenol around to fight that fever. It's this force of death that comes in, and with the same authority, Jesus is able to make the demon run away and to make this fever go away as well. And then notice what the first thing that she does is to come back into that community and bring that community back together. It's not just about making her well. It's about making the whole community well.
One more story about healing. We have time for two quick stories. All right, we'll do a couple quick stories. Look at chapter 7. Really briefly here. These are stories you might know. Here again, we have a story about a man and a story about a woman right next to each other. So from verses 1 to 10, we have a story about a centurion. It's a very powerful person. The centurion has a servant that he's very concerned about who's sick. The centurion sends friends to Jesus. The centurion never actually talks to Jesus directly. But he sends his friends to him to say, look, I need your help. So Jesus starts going to visit the centurion, which is probably not a great idea. The centurion is a representative of Roman power, of this Roman invasion of this area. But Jesus is willing to go all the way there. But even before he can get to the centurion's house, the centurion sends more people to say, Jesus, if you just say the word, then I know my servant will be well. Look, for example, at verse 8. This is the centurion speaking. For I am also a man set under authority. There's that word authority again. With soldiers under me. And I say to one, go, and he goes. And to another, come, and he comes. And to my slave, do this, and the slave does it. And when Jesus heard this, he was amazed at him. And turning to the crowd that followed him, he said, I tell you, not even in Israel have I found such faith. Which is a rather extraordinary thing, again, for Jesus to say about the enemies of Israel in their midst. What faith did Jesus see in this man? I think the faith that Jesus sees is that the centurion knows what power can do. The centurion knows what a general with an army behind them can do. That army can pacify a people, can conquer a people, can kill a people. But that army cannot bring life. And when that centurion looks at Jesus, he sees a power that's like his and not like him. It's like him in that it's powerful, but it's unlike him in that instead of that power bringing death, that power brings life. And his faith is seeing into the depths of Jesus' power, this Galilean peasant without an army, he sees in him the power to bring life. Right after this, then, we have the story of the widow of Nain. This is a story you probably have heard, right? This widow has a son who's died. The whole community is coming behind them in this funeral procession. And Jesus sees her and has compassion for her, according to verse 13. If you read the story, you'll notice that she never speaks. She never asks for Jesus' help. She doesn't have like the bold faith that the centurion has, who goes sends people to go right up to Jesus and say, please do this for me. I wonder if she's so deep in grief, so deep in loss, having lost a husband and a son, that she can't even bring to words her deepest hopes. But Jesus has compassion for her, and I think sees faith in her. I don't know about you, but sometimes my faith is like the centurion. It's bold, it's daring. It asks Jesus for everything I can hope for. But sometimes I have faith like the widow. I'm not even sure what to ask for. I'm so deep in grief, so deep in hopelessness, that I don't even know if God can rescue me from where I am. Both of those are forms of faith. And I think that's why Luke puts these two stories together, so that we don't always have to look like the centurion as people of faith. We can look like the deeply grieving widow. And that we need the stories of both to know the full extent of what faith might look like. All right, really, last story. Turn with me. Yes, so chapter 8. Let's start in verse 26. All right. They arrive at the country of the Gerasenes. This is the one and only time in the Gospel of Luke that Jesus is around Gentiles. He's always around Israelites. So this is opposite Galilee. As he stepped out on land, a man of the city who had demons met him. For a long time he had worn no clothes, and he did not live in a house, but in the tombs. He lived among the dead, because he himself, in a sense, was that space between life and death. When he saw Jesus, he fell down before him and shouted at the top of his voice, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, do not torment me." For Jesus had commanded the unclean spirit to come out of the man. For many times it had seized him. He was kept under guard and bound with chains and shackles. but he would break the bonds and be driven by the demon into the wilds. Jesus then asked him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Legion," for many demons had entered him. Legion is also what you call the Roman army. It's that force, that violent force of empire that's invaded this man in his body. It's a force that has invaded him and made him to live on the very edge of death, with no clothes, being chained by his neighbors. Think about the fear that his neighbors had for him, the way they would hope they would just keep wandering in the wilderness. Don't come to us. Hang out with the dead in the tombs. Hang out in the wilderness. But don't be here because you're too dangerous for us. Then we know the rest of the story, right? There's this herd of swine. The demon goes over to the swine. Jesus sends the demons over to the swine, even though the demons ask Jesus not to send them into the abyss. What do the swine do right away? They go right into the water. In ancient Israelite imagination, the water is the abyss. The water is a place of chaos. These demons, even though they know, we don't want to go back to the abyss, all that they can do is bring death and destruction. That's all they know how to do. So the swine herd saw this. They run off. They tell the people what they've seen. Look at verse 35. The people came out to see what had happened, and when they came to Jesus, they found the man from whom the demons had gone sitting at the feet of Jesus, clothed and in his right mind. And they were delighted. No. Right. They were surprised. They were ecstatic that this demon-possessed man could now live among them. No. What were they? They were afraid. And then later on, they tell Jesus, "Jesus, can you please go away?" Why were they afraid? I think they were afraid because as long as death and destruction were in one man's body, and he was hanging out in the tombs and in the wilderness, and we could chain him down, then those forces of death and destruction would not come attack me or my family. But when that guy showed up, seemingly well of mind, clothed in the middle of them, they got really afraid. Because if death, where did death and destruction go? What if they now come to me? They were worried, perhaps, too, that maybe Jesus' healing abilities would only last so long. What if the guy would go right back to who he was? If I were Jesus, I would take this guy with me. Because this community cannot accept him as a child of God. They're always going to see him as that crazy person, right? That guy with the demon, that guy who would walk around with no clothes. If I were Jesus, I would take him with me. Well, what does Jesus do? The guy wants to go with Jesus. I think he sees what his future is going to look like. And instead, Jesus says to him, "You stay here. You tell them what God has done for you." It's not enough to heal the one person. It was important to heal that whole community. As long as that one man was unclothed and chained and shackled, hanging out with the dead, then that community was not the community that God had called them to be. As long as that unclean demon had invaded that other man's body, he could not be a part of his community. As long as that widow had lost her son, that son was no longer part of that community. They had lost a sense of who they were. When Jesus heals individuals, he also heals communities. He stitches community back together. Healing, then, is not just some miracle done for the sake of fireworks. Healing is a way of bringing communities back together. And tomorrow, we will hang out and look at the many ways that Jesus eats and drinks, and the way that he brings communities back together in that simple everyday activity of eating bread and drinking wine. So come hungry tomorrow, and we'll talk about those stories. Any questions before we close? We have a few minutes here. I'm going to pass this just to make sure everybody can hear well.
Not a question so much as just a comment about the centurion. It seems to me what he did was make a confession that your power is... because he says, "I too am set under authority." So he was recognizing in Jesus that there was an authority that Jesus represented that then he was passing on. Yeah. So it was really a confession.
I think that's right. And what I find really striking then is the presence. This is where one of these moments where I think Luke's orderly account becomes clear to us.
Because you could tell that story of the centurion by itself. But instead he tells the story of the centurion and the story of this widow. A powerful person, a less powerful person. A person of able to make a deep confession with his words. A person so deep in grief that she doesn't have the words to make that confession. To say that faith runs from him to her, from her to him and back and forth. And then we often find ourselves in those. So I think you're right to name that the way that he's confessing the shape of Jesus' power. But I think we can't understand the shape of faith without also looking at her in her own confession, right? That grief itself is a form of confession. That hopelessness is itself a form of confession as well.
We're working really hard to be more inclusive and using the language of all are welcome here, and you made comment to that, and maybe being welcoming, but worshiping in our manner. Are you going to reflect more on that this week and what that might look like? As, you know, we're trying so hard to promote that message,
yes.
And it can be so complicated.
It is. So I think... yes, we'll talk more about that, but I think just recognizing that it's complicated is an important first step, right? That it's not enough to say the words. We also have to invite radical change in our midst, and that is really hard work. And here's, I think, what's really, really hard is I think it's important for majority cultures to know their stories really well. And what I'm calling for, and I think what Scripture is calling for, is not for us to get rid of those stories and adopt somebody else's stories, but how can we tell our stories in a way that instead of closing the doors, opens them to other people's stories as well? So it's not about getting rid of our stories, it's about opening up our stories to other people's stories as well. So we'll spend some time talking about that this week. But I do think just recognizing that it's hard is really important, and even starting the work by itself is really important. Just because of the isolatedness, the literal isolatedness of this place, you don't have to do that, right? You could just keep doing the thing that you're doing. But that what you think is that the gift of the story of this place and the gift of the story of the people who've come here is so valuable, and God has spoken so clearly that that's a story you want others to hear as well, and that you want to hear the stories that other people might tell in this place as well. So, yeah, we'll talk more about that along the way. And I think the other piece for me is, this is my first time at Holden. I can't tell this community how to do that. But what I can do, I think, is help us turn to certain texts of Scripture that hopefully will provoke our imaginations and help us think more broadly, or help this community think more broadly about what that inclusion might look like. So, absolutely, we'll come back to that. Yes.
Well, I've been reading Luke probably for the first time since confirmation class. And I was noticing, as I'm progressing through with these stories, at the end of them, sometimes Jesus says, you know, go and tell what has happened here. And sometimes he says, don't tell what has happened here. What's that about?
So part of it is leftovers from the Gospel of Mark. In Mark, Jesus is always telling people, don't say anything. So what do people do right away is they start talking right away, right? Like they can't help themselves. So I think Mark does that as kind of this literary device to say, despite Jesus trying to like keep things contained, the gospel just keeps spilling over and over. So I think there's some of that too. I think often, I wonder if for Luke, Jesus gives people different kinds of calls, right? Sometimes go and tell, sometimes don't tell, sometimes stay, sometimes go, right? He tells the disciples to leave everything they have. But he tells the Gerasene demoniac, no, stay here. And some of the people will read about tomorrow as well. He keeps telling them to stay in places. But what I think is really striking about a lot of these stories is that they're incomplete. Like, Luke doesn't tell us the whole story. Luke doesn't tell us if they go and tell people, mm-hmm. if they keep quiet. And I think that this is also part of Luke's orderly account, and the way that Luke is provoking our imaginations is that for us to wonder, what did they do? What did they do when Jesus left? And again, we'll talk about that some more tomorrow. So, great question.
The Gerasene is, all he wants to do is go with Jesus.
Yeah.
And Jesus makes him stay and gives him an almost impossible task.
Mm-hmm.
This man has had nothing but evil put upon him. He's been marginalized. He's been outcast or worse.
Mm-hmm.
And I see this a lot in our culture, that we make the victim and the afflicted and the marginalized carry an impossible burden to then redeem the rest of us. And I think that's really hard for me to accept when Jesus puts that on the people who shouldn't have to do that. So I just was wondering if you have a response to that or if there's a better way to see that.
Yes, I think you're right about that. Like I said earlier, right, if I were Jesus, I would have said, you know what, let's go. Like, you go, like, he keeps taking all these people out of their homes, out of their communities, right? This is what disciples do, but he asks him to stay.
And I guess, why is it on him
to
stay and to do this for everybody else?
In a lot of ways, I don't know, right? I don't understand what Jesus is doing here, but let me take one step back on the healing thing. Often when I'm teaching these healing stories, I say, we do not get to name for other people their wholeness. Let me tell you what I mean by that. When I was doing CPE, I was doing CPE with a hospital chaplain who has cerebral palsy and can walk some, but also often spent a lot of time in a wheelchair. And he told me there's all these stories about strangers coming up to him, people who don't know his story, people who don't know who he is, at the post office, at the grocery store, tapping him on the shoulder and saying, you know, if you prayed hard enough, you'd be able to get out of this wheelchair. We do this a lot in less explicit ways, but no less harmful ways, in the ways that we use language of blindness and deafness in our hymns and in our prayers. Think about what it would be like to be a blind person, or a person who is blind, or a person who is deaf, having their condition associated with sin all the time. We do this all the time, right? So what I mean by that is we don't get to name other people's wholeness. We don't get to say to them, you know, one day when Jesus heals you, because we don't know what they need to be healed of. So back to this question. I think Jesus gets to name other people's wholeness because he's Jesus. We're not Jesus. And I think in this case, too, we often call the victims to be the saviors of a community. But we're not Jesus to do that. I think sometimes victims of, whether it's oppression or violence, they feel called by Jesus to do that work. That's one thing. But for us to demand it, to expect it, to require it so that our communities can be made whole, I think that's the difference I see. And I want Jesus to do something different there. I really do. But I think I wonder, too, if it's that provocation of the gospel, of the mismatch between what I want Jesus to do and what he actually does, is where our imaginations are most in play. I've not heard somebody make this connection, and that's super helpful. And if you don't mind, I might borrow some of that insight at some point. So it's really beautifully said. Anything else you want to follow up on? Because I think it's a really important point. Anything else you want to say about that? No, sorry. Good. So I think there's some questions over there, if you don't mind passing the microphone along.
Just a response to that, which I really agree with, that we do that. Mm-hmm. What I see in this case is Jesus, like you say, naming his wholeness because he was isolated from community. People wouldn't even talk to him, and he couldn't talk to people. And now what Jesus knows is that he gets to go back into community. He gets to talk to people. He gets to proclaim for them who he is.
Although we don't know how the community reacts. We don't know if they treat him any differently. And this is a question that we're going to come into tomorrow as well with a couple of stories. We don't know what happens after Jesus leaves. So we'll come back to this very point tomorrow.
One thought I have in this is reflecting on my experience in moving from a small town and as a freshman going into an inner city school. I remember sitting in an English class and we were reading out loud, and there was a black woman, or black student, who was reading, and she was stumbling over words, and I was sitting right across, you know, the rows of desks, and I kept giving her what the word was, you know, that. And finally she got frustrated with me and turned to me and she said, I can read, just shut up. So my point being that that's the piece we need to learn in our Lutheran churches or any Protestant church, is that we're not there to help them. We're here to walk alongside. And, you know, and that was a real eye-opener for me as a kid, you know, to realize that, yeah, I mean, she's struggling, but I'm not there to help. I'm not going to fix her.
No.
I was there, and, you know, and I went through other experiences in that setting where then I think that Black culture was testing me as a white kid. I remember one where I was in the bathroom and there were a group of Black students in there, and I washed my hands and took the towel, was drying it, and a kid right next to me, a Black kid, took and threw the wet towel that he used in my face. The anticipation there was that I was going to react and get in a fight, right? Instead, I just looked at him in a puzzled way and walked away. Whether that probably was the Holy Spirit guiding me at that time,
yeah, right.
You know. But you know, we're here to walk alongside. Yeah. You know, not.
I think one of the issues that we keep facing is that we center our, especially people in majority culture, we center all our wholeness and make everybody else live up to those standards. And this is works around disability theology and theology of disabilities have really opened my eyes to these realities. That see, I just did it. That was ableist, right? opening my eyes to this. That we tend to put supposedly whole bodies, right, at the center of wholeness and healing. There was, when Stephen Hawking died, was it last year or the year before? There was a cartoon of Stephen Hawking coming to the pearly gates and walking out of his wheelchair. And one of my students at Luther, who herself has a disability, was voicing her concern about that and the ways that that tells certain people that their bodies aren't good enough for God's kingdom. And what did a bunch of people do is to push back and say, well, that's not what that means. What if we imagine that it's God and God alone who determines what wholeness looks like? And our job isn't to tell some people what their wholeness is, but to walk alongside them and hear how God is already making communities and people whole, to hear the kind of healing that's happening there, and that maybe the healing that God is doing in that community might spill over and make me well in ways I didn't know I needed. Last question in the back, so we're going to back here, last one, and then we'll get some lunch. We've got 3 minutes.
I think the thing that you just said spoke exactly to why Jesus may have left the man there.
Mm-hmm.
Is that we didn't know what he needed.
But Jesus did.
But Jesus did.
Yeah. That's at the end, that's the best answer I can give it. It also feels unsatisfying because, again, I want Jesus taken with them. But I wonder if that's what's happening there. Again, notice how these stories are kind of unfinished. I think Luke does that on purpose because Luke wants us to have these conversations. And even more conversations we'll have tomorrow when we join Jesus at all these delicious meals that he keeps finding himself teaching and learning from. All right, that's it for today. Thank you so much, friends. We'll see you tomorrow.